welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today, the Spiral Heads takeover of Turned Out of Punk continues as my buddy, Jim Carroll, guitarist of the band, comes to the show. Also, guitarist in The Hope Conspiracies, The Suicide File, A-Team, Clouds, Pure Love. There's a lot to talk about with this guy, and I am excited for you to hear it. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, hit up the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who's the show producer, and normally guest booker extraordinaire, but I booked this one all by myself, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left for Damian on those. There is a Turned Out of Punk Facebook page, TikTok page, YouTube page, Instagram page. All those are found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. To support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them know that we do this thing. And I play in a band. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. And that is it. On to today's show. Today on the show, as I said off the top, Jim Carroll is here in celebration of this new Till I'm Dead Spiral Heads record, which is just dropping this week if you're listening to this as this thing is coming out. You can also check out the episode with his bandmate, Simon Doom, and record producer of this record and other records, but this record specifically, Walter Schreifels, on this feed. And I'm very excited to talk to him. As I said before, someone I've known for a long time. I'm sure I met him back when he was an A-Team, but I really remember him around the time of Clouds, one of the bands he played in. And anyway, this is someone who, as I said, has played in a lot of different types of bands, all within the punk hardcore world, but different sects of this thing. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. You'll hear it all go down in 1 second. Check out the Spiral Heads record, and that is it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Jim Carroll on Turned Out of Punk. If you do want to get an argument, we can get the argument too.
Let's do it. I was just waiting for you to start recording.
Yeah,
so we'll go for it.
Let's talk about some shit. Well, Jim, let's talk about some shit. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on here because you're someone that has existed in so many different bands, different styles of bands. And I do feel like A-Team is a band that's really responsible for like the early 80s hardcore resurgence in the beginning of the 2000s and doesn't really get sort of the credit or mention that they deserve.
Okay. I mean, I'll take it. Sure.
We'll get there, but we got to start off the way they all start off, Jim, which is how'd you get into punk from the first time you ever came across it?
I mean, I feel like I came into it like a lot of people do. Like I was, you know, when I was younger, I was like into metal, huge into like Metallica and Anthrax, you know, the big four, and like through those bands, sort of, you know, seeing t-shirts of like Black Flag and the Misfits and just sort of starting to poke around record stores and see, you know, like, oh, this is Metallica likes this. I'm going to buy this record, and like asking my mom to buy me a tape. And getting like the first collections of the Misfits and just going from there. And then like, you know, naturally finding out like, oh, there's a local scene and getting to into local shows, and you know, good. It was just this huge jump off point into the world.
Metallica is such an important kind of on-ramp band during that period by doing those Misfits covers and bringing Suicidal on tour and just kind of doing the outreach.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, got me into Killing Joke, which is like one of my favorite bands. Definitely a huge gateway band for me.
Yeah, I think for me it was seeing them on that Septic Death record where I'm like, oh, I gotta buy the Septic Death record. Metallica plays on it, and this is the guy that does all that art. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, like all the Pusshead stuff had the like easily had the coolest merch, always wore their own merch, and it was just like, oh yeah, these guys rule. Then they inevitably went down the rabbit hole of becoming very lame, but that's just how it goes.
I had to go. I went and listened to the new record when it came out, and I was like, "This is actually kind of." It feels like at a certain point, every band goes, "You know what? This is what the fans want." Like, why are
For
we?
sure. Yeah. But it thought like I've also gone back and listened to the newer stuff, and it's like, yeah, there's, they still can come up with some riffs, but it all seems like it seems like they lean into like, let's chop this stuff together, like very Pro Toolsy. And yeah, it doesn't feel as natural.
It also it's interesting as they've kind of become like the Grateful Dead of this era in a way. And so all those songs feel like they're written in a way that you can jam them out on stage and you can
For
kind of
sure.
take them different places. Like I was listening to it, I'm like, oh, this is definitely probably what a Dead kind of songwriting process was. Like, how do we make this work with 50,000 people rocking out?
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
So, what were some of the first local bands that you kind of heard about?
I mean, there was like Sam Black Church and Tree, those Boston, like that era of Boston bands. And like, that Sam Black Church was one of the big ones because there was this place, Sir Morgan's Cove, an old club in Worcester, and they did an all ages matinee and like convinced my mom to like let me go to that. And like, that was insane because at that time it was like, you see Jet like jumping 10 feet in the air and like climbing on rafters. And yeah, that was pretty mind blowing. And then there was like a bigger local festival in Worcester called it would at first it was called like Local Palooza, and then it was called Loco Bazooka.
They got that
Because I
Perry
think they got
Farrell.
yeah I think they got sued by Lollapalooza, but yeah, that was like always within like a mile of my house, so it's like get dropped off there and you just see like a bunch of local bands. But also like big headliners. Like I saw Faith No More at one of them, and yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I'm trying to think of, and also like say, but as far as like a hardcore band that like sort of changed the trajectory, it was like I remember the first time seeing Bane as like a local band, because those shows were just absolutely insane. Like never seen a response like that for like any band, because I had started seeing like I'd seen Sick of It All, and like you go to like I was big into the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, and like that was also a huge gateway band. So seeing like those bigger hardcore shows and like sort of like hockey arenas and stuff like that, but then seeing like a local show, like a Bane show, that's like in a 200 cap room and everyone's just like jumping from everywhere, and like that was a mind-blowing experience where it was just like, oh shit, this is something special.
Yeah, like I didn't see Bane in Worcester till 99, and I think it's the Palladium, right? That was the one with the two floors, like an upstairs floor
Yeah,
and a
the
basement.
upstairs, yeah.
And I would put that up with Gauze in Tokyo in terms of a reaction to a band that just felt by the place so unique. Like I'd never seen kids were doing backflips off the stage, like it, and it was aggressive, but like the most happy, positive kind of vibe to it too. It was completely mind-blowing.
For sure. Yeah. It was like, I mean, still, and I feel like I say like we'll say this to people where it's like, because Bane has become like some this,
Ubiquitous, yeah.
yeah. And I'll say like, oh, those first to the first few times I saw Bane were just like the absolutely most special, insane shows, because it's like, oh, this band is from here. Like it's like when it clicked, where it's like this band is from here, and like I'm seeing this like insane, unique, over the top reaction to, and it, yeah, it would just kind of like changed everything.
I think it's also interesting how Massachusetts, out of all kind of like the state's hardcore scenes, like a lot of it stayed internal. Like eventually, Bane and In My Eyes and Suicide File and like all this stuff kind of explodes out and becomes international. But like, unless you're from Massachusetts, I don't think you can understand the importance of Sam Black Church.
Oh yeah, no, it's a very local, regional. But yes, well, actually, I have surprisingly seen, there is that whole, there's a huge interest in the 90s resurgence right now, and I have seen some surprising, like, oh yeah, like people wearing like Sam Black Church shirts or putting it on like a playlist. I'm like, really? Okay. Like, I just didn't think it translated to, this, it's like the white guy attempt at Bad Brains is, and but very, yeah, very unique. And it was, I'm surprised that it, in the places that it's popped up sometimes.
Well, I think it's all like people like yourselves championing them too, to the sort of
Yeah.
young, hearing about this band, because certainly growing up at the time, I hear their names, see them on flyers. Eventually I found some records, but it was
Also the coolest logo.
cool ass logo. You're right. That
Yeah.
maybe if I'd seen the logo first, I would have made more of an attempt to sought it out. But it just
Yeah.
wasn't on the radar in the way that stuff from New York was, stuff from New Jersey was, even at that
Right.
time. And like there, it felt like there was Boston was like an island unto itself. And it goes all the way back, like Bullet Travolta, La Travolta. Like there's just so many bands from there that just are massively important, but
Yeah.
just didn't seem to tour as much, or I don't know why it was.
Yeah, that, I mean, yeah, that Bullet La Volta stuff, like I don't think it's gone on Spotify yet. I think I have it on like a hard drive somewhere, but that band was very underappreciated for, yeah, just one of the best of that era, but just non-existent currently.
And but it's also like, even I remember going to Worcester for the first time, and this is obviously after the era that you're talking about where Bane first shows up, but I was shocked at how big that scene was and how many bands kind of came out of Worcester.
Yeah.
And it's not that far from Boston. I guess it's like Hamilton to Toronto kind of distance, but it felt like it was as big enough to just be its own separate entity.
For it definitely was. And also, like, yeah, there, like you said, like there was so many, it was always a stopover point for bands. Like there were so many shows that I see flyers for shows in Boston now in the era that I was like well into going to shows, and I'm like, why didn't I go to that show? And then realizing, like, oh yeah, that band played in Worcester the next day, so like wouldn't go to the Boston show. Yeah, it's I mean, very lucky that it was just like out at the at my doorstep, like discovering once I realized, like, oh, the Espresso Bar in Worcester, the space that, like I said, Sir Morgan's Cove and all those spots, like, and then like all the halls and yeah, all like surrounding towns, there were like lots of VFW hall shows, and there was just, it was a lot going on. And I always champion Worcester for being, there was definitely a lot going on apart from the Boston scene. And it seems like it still is that way. It seems like it's like still a thriving scene, obviously not as in touch with it as I used to be, but yeah, it was great. I was very lucky growing up and just kind of having all of that at my disposal.
Yeah, like it felt during that sort of late 90s period, like Wilkes-Barre. There's definitely some other places. I'm Oakville, for to make it local and insert myself in there. Like it felt like
Okay.
there were a lot of places that were outside of the quote unquote like major city or the capital city that became kind of like the hotbeds of hardcore and punk. And I think Worcester more than Boston. Like maybe it's because Lou had joined the Swarm and I was such a big Bane fan during that time period
Right.
that,
Yeah.
but it
I
did.
forgot about that connection.
Yeah, strong. Barrett used to come up here and play quite a
Yeah.
bit. I think they played here three times or something back then.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a, but it always felt like Worcester was during that era the place that I'd want to go. I'm like, oh yeah, Boston's cool, but like Worcester's where all the cool young bands are, and it's like all the straight edge kids.
It's like it's like when I say to people like, oh, I've been to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania quite a few times, and they're like, why? Like, why? And having to explain, like, oh, you know, it used to be a there used to be a lot going on there. And or yeah.
It was a cultural capital at one point.
It was. And yeah, Worcester had that title for, I mean, you know, like I said, it still seems like there's a ton going on there. So which is great.
So, who were the Terribles?
The Terribles were my brother's band. My brother played drums in the Terribles. It was like his high school band. And it was this guy, Jamie Buckmaster, played guitar and sang. And another friend of ours, Mike Leslie, he played bass. And there was just like the band that played, like, practiced all the time in my mom's basement. And they were great. Like, they like definitely they, I mean, they had a good following at a certain point, but like, I mean, Jamie was like such a good songwriter, and he was like the guy in high school where he was just like the weirdo freak kid, but like super talented artist, just like wrote songs. It seemed like he was just like endlessly writing songs, and they practiced all the time, and they were awesome. Like sort of like early SST influence, like Minutemen, I guess some like Husker Du influence, like melodic, but like some harder songs, and then just some weirdo out there psychedelic stuff. And great. I love that you brought that
And they
up.
were around for a long time too, right? Like way into the
They were.
2000s.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't even know. Like, I had moved to Boston, and like I know that they were still going, but it's like and they kind of like got into the arty scene of Boston. But I didn't see I didn't I don't think I had like really seen any shows after I moved to Boston. But yeah, they were a band pretty much the whole time I was in high school. Sorry, my cat's attacking something. And then yeah, into like 2002, 2003 probably.
I think no, the last record I think was released in 2017.
Oh, I mean, that must have been like
A
a
reunion?
re-release
Yeah.
of yeah, I don't know. I would have to consult my brother about that, but I'm not really sure. I know that they weren't playing in 2017. But
Just back together for the CDR.
yeah. They had like a CDR that had like, I remember it having like 30 songs on it. Like that was their output was just constant.
Well, it's so funny because, like, in punk and hardcore, specifically hardcore, you're like you kind of take it for granted that if you've been a band for that long, there would be like a glut of vinyl releases. But the Terribles seem like minus the 1/7-inch, like DIY the whole
Oh
way
yeah.
through.
Yeah, I think my brother was like drawing all the artwork, and yeah, and just I like printing CDRs at my mom's house and all of that. Yeah.
Would that scene cross over at all with sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, the Youth Crew revival scene or whatever that scene kind of morphed into by that point? Like, or is it really separate?
It was, I mean, it was like all of like local kids. I don't know. I don't think the A Team and the Terribles ever played together, but there was this band, the Goonies, which was sort of the in between. They were like a ska punk band, and they were great. Like they were just like local. I remember meeting. I met the guitar player at summer school because I think he was wearing a Bane shirt and I was wearing a Proclamation shirt. And so it was like that, like, oh, like I'm gonna talk to this guy. And then that ended up being Danny Bignuts, And he played guitar in the Goonies. And then we, yeah, like, and then other people in my friend group knew like some of their friend group. And so they became this band where we would go see them all the time. And them and the Terribles would play together a lot. And like the A Team was starting around that time, but we never crossed over into that scene. And definitely not like the youth crew. That was like, I think that was pretty separate. Maybe not those bands specifically, but they kind of like got into like the Basement Show mass art scene in Boston. And maybe there were like, I know like early on, AN played some of those house shows. But it was pretty limited as far as like that crossover.
When A-Team came out, the thing that I think really set them apart to me was like I love the records, obviously, but I mean like the fact that it didn't need a modifier in front of it. Like if you were going to be a hardcore band playing fast hardcore back then, you'd have to be like, oh, we're a power violence band, or
Right.
we're a youth crew band, or we're a thrash revival band, or like there was always
Right.
like, but A-Team was just like, and there. A lot of bands came after, but I remember that being one of the first bands that was just like, we're a hardcore band. And that was the, didn't need a qualifier.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, at least when we started, like we were all still in high school. And I feel like it was just before that sort of thrash revival thing like came to light, at least for like me seeing it. But I remember when we started, it was like we were trying to do a band like Murphy's Law. Like that was what we were going for. Like, oh, it definitely like a New York influence, but we, you know, John and Q and Brian coming from this sort of ska side of things. Like they were all in a reggae and ska band together. So there was that element of like goofiness. And like, you know, on the demo, John writing songs about Bald Bull from Mike Tyson's Punch Out. Like there was definitely a goofiness. So I think it was sort of going for that Murphy's Law sound, like a little bit more fun. And then over time, just it got a little bit harder and a little more crossovery sound. It's like a little, you know, yes, a straight hardcore band.
Yeah, and it's funny with the ska stuff because like it kind of works live at any type of show. Like you're saying the ska band, the Goonies being the bridge band, but it does it is
Yes.
this genre that I don't listen to a lot of it, but at the same time, like in a live show to break stuff up, and it's also like very much I guess Murphy's Law the same way, like very much concerned about putting on a fun live show. Like you don't have to be serious to do it.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's very much I at it was very much a, you know, a teenage like a them to go through that where it's like, oh yeah, we just want to have fun. So it's like this is the type of band that we're gonna do. It's just like this goofy, nerdy our take on reggae. And it was like, yeah, very much like trying to be sort of Mighty Mighty Bosstones and Bim Scala Bim, that sort of thing. And then like they also, some of them started like more traditional reggae bands like later on. And but you know, when you're like 12 or 13, you're just like hyped up on caffeine and wanting to play ska punk, apparently. That was all kind of before we started hanging out, before the A Team started, but like it was still there when the band was starting.
And Boston's one of the places that kind of birthed, I guess, what would now be called ska punk, but like, you know, ska
For
core back
sure.
then with Boston's and
For
Bim Scala
sure.
Bim. And like, yeah, it's interesting too. Boston always seems to have so many seemingly isolated scenes from each other, but like a lot of different representations of punk at the same
Yeah.
time, be it oi skinhead stuff or ska stuff or hardcore stuff or like the artier stuff, like you were saying.
Well, it's also like just, I think, New England in general, because it's like so many different regional spots, like all shoved together in close proximity. Like, you know, I remember, I mean, like, talk about like a juxtaposition getting. the A team booked on a show in New Hampshire by some friends of ours, and then this band that it was our friend Evan's band, this band The Drunks, who were from like southern New Hampshire, and then going to the show in like more northern New Hampshire and rolling up, and there's like two massive skinheads with like White Pride Worldwide shirts on,
Whoa.
and our and we have an Asian bass player, and we're just like sitting in the car like, what do we do here?
Yeah.
Like, because our friends got us on the show, and we were like, what's
I think Boston is in a lot of ways like Toronto in that we had an incredibly militant anti-Nazi thing that swept through here in the 80s where like dudes
for
went to straight
sure.
up war. So there were definitely moments where Nazis would show up, but it was not at all a regular occurrence. Like I can count on my
Yeah.
hand how many times I saw Nazis at shows in Toronto in 20 plus years.
Yeah, it just didn't happen in Massachusetts. Like
Yeah.
it had gotten taken care of long before that. And I remember like starting to hang out with people from like Northern California, and like the amount of times that they would talk about like, oh yeah, when like Nazis would roll up, or like friends from like Pennsylvania or something. Like it just wasn't an occurrence at my in my era of that of Massachusetts hardcore. Like it just didn't exist, which was great.
Was
But
awesome. Yeah.
it was also a surprise when you like roll up to like a more rural region of New England. It's like, oh, this is it's still here. And for some reason, like they're just, you know, they want this younger hardcore band to play. But to and not to let and not throwing our friends under the bus, like they didn't know when the like when they got us the show, they didn't know that that was going on. Like we all kind of had like a
When Bartiz Strange was on the podcast, he was telling the story about join me and these skateboard kids, and them being like, "We have a G.G. Allin cover band," and you know, joining the cover band, showing up at their first show, and walking out there, and it's just all neo-Nazis, and just like a
Jesus.
whole crowd, and he's like, all these neo-Nazis after the show are coming up to him like, "Hey, brother, thank you for supporting our movement," and he's just like, "What the fuck is this?"
Where what where was this? Where is he from?
He had moved to Virginia when this happened.
Okay.
So yeah,
All
it
right.
was, and I
Yep.
don't, it wasn't Richmond. It was
Right.
another part, I guess.
Right.
It is a, and like, I'm sure there are people who have to deal with some of this shit still to this day, but it does
Oh, for
feel like
sure.
it was like a weird relic. Even then, it felt like when you'd see it outside of one of these cities where it didn't happen as much.
Yeah, it was such a strange. I remember it was such a strange thing to see, and I was like grateful at the t definitely at the time. I was like, I'm glad that this like isn't a thing in all of this like local scenes that we. I can only imagine how it is now with like, you know, that sort of far right wing Trumper. I don't like. I know that. I'm sure there's some like intertwined scene beef that goes on, but
But and I think back
I'm
then
not
also,
privy to
yeah. Well, I think like you said back then, you're also flying into a lot of these shows, kind of blind, like where you show up
Oh,
at the show,
completely.
you know, and you have
Yeah.
no idea what the kids are like, you have no idea what the scene's like. Whereas now, I think you could do a little bit more due diligence and find out the stuff in advance because we just have the means to do it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, this was like, I mean, I'm gonna say it was like 99. Yeah, I don't like no besides like the Rev Board. That was it. Like, I don't know. We were probably going off of like some printed out MapQuest directions and yeah.
Didn't we have X Mullet X, or is that in the
I don't
2000
know if
already?
I feel like that was post 2000,
Just after, I think, yeah.
2001 maybe.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think 2001 was when the mullet board started.
So do you guys, you're just doing road trips at this point, or were you touring on just the demo?
We didn't tour until like 2000, 2001. So like I had moved to Boston late 2000. And we did our first tour that winter. Or to the winter of 2001, like when basically when, so you know, John and Brian and the A team and Q, they were all in school in Boston. So we had like a winter break, or they had a winter break, and we put together a tour with a Close Call. And yeah, that was like our first little run, and it was like we went up, went up to Canada.
Yeah, play
I think we
Toronto.
played with Career Suicide, I believe, that show, or maybe that was the second time we played.
No, I think it was the
I think
first time.
actually, I think both times we might have played with Career Suicide
Yeah, that
at that
makes sense.
little, what was that,
Q Bar.
Q Bar?
Yeah,
Yes.
which that's a huge show for Toronto. To me, that I look at that
Yeah.
show as being like one of those
Didn't
shows where
feel huge at the
no, it definitely, it doesn't matter how many bodies were in the room, it's where the bodies went afterwards, right?
So you're saying it was like the first time the Sex Pistols played in
Exactly. People lie about being there all the time now, but it did feel like it was like, oh, this is going to be like, we're going to have like a kind of a Toronto hardcore scene. And it was interesting because A-Team was beloved by both Toronto hardcore camps at the time, which definitely did not get along with each other. So,
I remember that was like a bit, that was like one of those moments. Sorry, not to cut
no,
you
please
off.
go ahead. Yeah.
If, because we played like the Anthrax I Am the Law intro, and I remember, and like Ben was moshing, and it was like, ah, cool, like this guy from this band likes our band, and then Career Suicide playing after us, and we were like blown away by them. And yeah, it was like that was great. That was just the first taste of like going around. I mean, your first tour, it's always like this sort of magical moment where you're just hanging out with friends and doing weird shit, and you got cooch in the van, so that's a whole thing. But like Close Call were like our they we did a few tours with them. And it was always fun, like just playing weird basements and middle of nowhere, driving overnight, sleeping in the van. It was great.
Well, it's one of those tours where, like, looking back on it, certainly Career Suicide here, but I'm sure you're playing with a lot of bands that maybe 2 or 3 years later would have their singles out and would be kind of like doing stuff.
I don't remember
Anyone else?
anyone significant.
Or I'm wrong.
Don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm not gonna say it was like a bust of a tour, but I don't really remember any other like significant bands that we played with. Like, I mean, there was one show where it was in, I want to say it was like Cincinnati or something. We played a basement show where there was no one there, and we just decided to go. We were like, well, we'll still play because like the people in the house were, it was an awesome, like they had an awesome setup like in their basement. It was sick. So we were like, oh, we'll still play for you guys. And we just like did a swap off, like one song or two songs, two songs, two songs, like just like bang, bang, both bands playing, switching instruments. And then we were like, okay, see you later, and just like drove off into the night.
Yeah, I think we've all had that basement show. We did one in Tacoma, maybe, and the people that lived in the house didn't even bother coming downstairs.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, there's something truly humbling about having a great show and people going nuts, and then the next day playing to like literally no one and being like, "Why
Yeah.
am I doing this?"
Yeah, I know. It's great. I mean, I still do it, so it's awesome.
Yeah,
Yeah.
same. I'd be lying if I said I didn't. I'm like, I would love to get to the position where you're just guaranteed. I don't want to be big or anything, but just 400 people every night, guaranteed. No questions asked. I'm like, that's all I need.
Yeah, I know. But it keeps you on your toes, you
Keeps you on
gotta
your
be,
toes.
and very humble as well.
Well, and like you're saying about Metallica, it changes the way you approach what you're doing if there is commercial success, I found.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't know, so.
Well, same here. I'm from observing from afar.
Right. No, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think with anything, not to say that I'm definitely not anti-capitalist or anti-money, but it's just like when you start dumping money on some sort of art, it just kind of breaks and doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't really resonate with me, where I think it's very difficult for an artist to stay connected to whatever their original, even if I just don't think it's feasible for an artist to, like, stay the course when money gets involved. I've yet to see it.
And I think it probably changes the motivations a little
For
bit. Like,
sure.
if you woke up and you're like, man, today I could donate some money and send 20 kids to college, or I could write a new song. And it's,
Right.
you kind of have, and I'm not saying it's bad. Like, I could be donating, I could probably be sending some kid to summer camp, maybe, but, but instead I'm making
Sure.
podcasts. So there is that kind of like, you have to decide.
For sure.
But at the same time, like, yeah, it must change it when you've got that much and that
Yeah.
much riding on it, that many people depending on it. Like, I'm jumping way ahead, but when you and Frank started that band,
Yeah.
I've never seen a pop star energy around someone. And this isn't Frank, like, Frank wasn't doing anything. This was just people coming at Frank. But, like,
For sure.
doing that Foo Fighters tour, even doing that tour with the Arcade Fire when they were kind of blowing up first, there weren't people stealing their clothes. There weren't, label people and media people always trying to get to them. Like, it was a lot more control. Whereas when we did that tour of the Gallows, when Frank, just before
Right.
Frank left, it was
Yeah.
crazy. People stealing his shoes. People, like,
Yeah.
it was a real manic kind of thing to kind of exist in.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those people that he just has this personality where, like, people are intrigued by it. People are, he does have that pop star energy. And, like, when we did Pure Love, it was very much, even though, like, we had moderate success and then it kind of blew up before anything. But, those shows were the people that went to those shows. It was just like we would always go to the merch booth after we played, and, like, people would just come up and, like, they wanted to just, like, see him, just because he is this sort of character that people are attracted to. And still, to this day, he's doing his thing.
Was the creative process working on that record because of the fact that there was, especially leaving the Gallows there was so much attention, I imagine, kind of external pressures put on that record. Did it change kind of the process of making it?
Yeah, I'd say yes and no. Like, we met, like, we had met years prior when Suicide File did a tour in the UK, and Gallows played with us, and so we met briefly then, and then, like, reconnected when he was living in Brooklyn, and we had just talked about, starting a band. And once we, like, got down to it, we were both just like, I don't really want to do a heavy band, so let's, like, fit. And he was like, I don't want to do that either, like, let's do something, like, a little bit more melodic. And so, like, we started writing songs. And at the beginning, it was, like, very much just like, let's write the song, like, oh, we're stoked on it, like, and so there was no, there was no pressure whatsoever at the beginning. And then, he left Gallows, and then we started talking to labels, and, like, once the label got involved, it, like, becomes a little bit more real. And they didn't pressure us. Like, we got signed to Vertigo, and they were trying to be like the They were trying to, like, redo Vertigo and, like, have a little resurgence and make it like we're the new rock and roll label. And so they kind of, like, let us do our thing, which was nice. Like, there was only one time where I think people from the label came and listened to the re like the pre-production stuff that we were doing. So no, it's, so it wasn't really that much pressure, but I think ultimately, the sort of, there was definitely a split, like, once we played our first show, where it's like people saw that the band was not Gallows at all. And so there were people that stuck with it, and there were new people that loved it. And then there were people that's like, oh, it's not hardcore, it's not Gallows, I'm gonna go, and it sucks, I'm not into it. So there was, I think there was that sort of pressure on him. Like, I didn't get it at all. I was like, I'm just writing songs that I want to write. But I think he kind of felt it reasonably, like, throughout the time that we were a band. And I think it was like, it was work to like get it going and like get, the show. Most, I'd say most of the shows we played were awesome, but it's like, it was hard work to just like, it was a building a new band, and I don't know if he was necessarily ready for that. And it, I think ultimately it like wore him down a little bit. So.
It and I think, like, once again, like the Sam Black Church outside of Massachusetts, you can't really appreciate it. I think unless you saw the gallows in England and kind of that level of, and I think maybe that, I don't know, maybe do you think it did the distance you guys had by being in Brooklyn versus like if you're trying to do the same thing in London where there was such a like feverish kind of energy around it?
Yeah, I mean, we only ever played one US show. We played in Brooklyn at St. Vitus. Like we were just in England and Europe like the whole time. So it was like we were both living there. I think that was also a thing. It was like we were both just like going back and forth to the UK all the time. So it's like yeah, I don't know if like where we were at necessarily had an effect on it, but I just don't, as it goes with a lot of things, I like following up this like force. I just don't think people understood what we were doing necessarily. And you're gonna inevitably like lose some of the his like hardcore fans. Like some people just aren't, it's not what they want. It's they like they want him to be crazy and screaming and just wasn't. And we I feel like I knew that that was gonna sort of happen, but what can you do?
Well, it's
Can't
interesting.
like
Oh, sorry.
change people's taste. No,
And it's
no.
interesting talking to like Wade, because from Alexis, because he stepped in afterwards, and just him coming out there, and he said like the people's reaction to it, like there was a lot of vitriol thrown at him because it wasn't what, like people's expectations are the hardest thing to deal with when you're in a fucking band, because
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
people
I
don't want.
mean, yeah.
Go on,
Yeah,
sorry.
I mean, I feel like we, with American Nightmare too, it's like we deal with that because it's like we still put out current music that we enjoy, and it's like people enjoy it, but there's so many diehards where it's like, well, it's not like background music, it's not like first 7-inch, and it's like, yeah, like what's the point of doing that over and over again? Like, I don't, I, it's. It's like just a common theme where you can't please anyone, so why try to?
Yeah, like unless you're out cold or maybe drop dead, you're not gonna
Sure.
find a way to please your fan base forever by doing the
Yeah.
same thing. Like, no diss on both those bands. Both those bands are like two of my
Oh
favorites,
no.
but
But also like Out Cold is like a band that they're like untouchable. They are like everything they did was good. And but I we would A team would play with them all the time and like it would be there'd be like 30 people there, 20, like no one cared. And that's another one of those bands where I always see on playlists now, like, oh my God, this band's so good. And it's like, yeah, like everyone's catching up now that they're like an untouchable hardcore band.
yeah, yeah, because we played one time at, oh, I can't remember the name of the record store. It wasn't Generations, but it was near that hot dog, Spike's hot dog place. I can't remember what it was.
No, it
It was
must say regeneration. It what? Because that
Regeneration,
was,
yes, Regeneration. That was where we played. Out Cold played before us, and getting on stage
Sick.
after them felt, that's a hard band to follow up because they are fucking
Absolutely.
amazing.
Just like stop on a dime, start again. Like just a, was Mikey and Stauffer in the band at that time?
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, Mikey was, because it would have been 2004,
Oh yeah.
I guess,
Yeah.
five maybe. Yeah, but it
Yeah.
was, and like Gauze, I guess. There's certain bands that just have a sound that they find, and they spend the rest of their time just refining it and working within that palette. But that's really fucking hard when you're trying to be a creative person.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, I think it's almost like, is it worse if you know that you found this? Like, I think it, like, do those people that find this sound, like, do they know that they're like, this is my sound, I'm just going to keep going with it? Or it's like, is it just something deep down that drives that, and you know, you just kind of are you like a pure artist where it just, this is what I do, and whether I know it or not.
What it's also fascinating because, like, yeah, not that we're doing this for commercial re means or anything like that, or reasons, as we've both you and I have clearly established. But at the same time, like, you do want people to react to what you do, and you do want people to
For sure.
respond to what you do.
For sure.
And so, like, the idea of doing like a whole career where you might be opening for some shitty hipster hardcore band, or you might be playing to 30 people, like, but to still believe in what you're doing, like, even if no one fucking gets it. What I'm
Yeah.
doing is amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think, I mean, at least personally, I feel like that was like my training at the beginning of like starting to play shows. And like, it, you know, there were so many A-team shows where like no one, either no one was there or like no one really gave a shit. And you know, that's sort of ingrained in you. It's like you play the show because you want to play the show, and you play it like you would any other time. Like, yeah, sure, people's, the crowd's energy informs your performance, and like, but you still have to just give it 100%. And that was ingrained early on, and I still feel like I do that. Like, I'll, you know, there's the handful of Spiralhead shows that we've played. You, like, some have been smaller, some have been bigger, and it's like you play them the same way.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I think that's what also separates punk in a lot of ways. Not that there's aren't underground scenes in every scene, but
Right.
I interviewed Craig Bell from Rock from the Tombs and the Mirrors and
Okay.
stuff, right? Like, so arguably one of the first punk kids.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the birth of wanting to do this style of music because you fucking love it and not because you don't care if anyone else gets it. You're gonna do it because you get it.
Right. I mean, especially at that time, like you're just a fucking weirdo, and like you're doing something relatively new, like obviously informed from whatever garage, noisy garage rock, and but like you're doing something, and you're just like probably playing at like bars for normal people and just like confusing everyone, and like maybe getting beaten up after. It's like that is, I'm in awe of like that early whatever proto punk or early punk, where it just, you know, we, you know, it, growing up like playing this type of music, it's like, yeah, you always like you get in fights with like high school jocks and or but not as much as like those people did,
Yeah,
because it
like,
was, you know, it's still it was a slightly more normal just to play in a band.
yeah, like I think there's the big one of the big divides is that post Nirvana, pre Nirvana period. Like, if you're a kid who got
For
into this
sure.
post Nirvana, It wasn't, but all that being said, it wasn't like everyone in my fucking high school liked punk. It was still like very few of us.
No.
I got thrown into a party one time for playing a Cramp CD. There was definitely some repercussions, but you're right. It's not like a bunch of jocks yelling, "Hey, Devo," at you before pelting you with fucking rocks because you're into this kind of music.
No, I was like, in high school, I was just the rocker kid. Yeah. Like, oh, you're a rocker? Cool.
Yeah.
Like that was it. Yeah, no, people at my high school didn't get it. I went to like Catholic school and it was very straight-laced, normal people for the most part. So,
I always say this is like a religion too. Like in the same way that we have this adherence to this, it doesn't matter if other people are telling you it's wrong. You believe in it, and here you and I are years later still adherence to this belief. Like it's more than just like a high school phase. This is like a life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I remember, you know, in high school you'd come in on a Monday and people would be like, "Oh yeah, I went to so-and-so's party," and people would be like, what did you do? And it's like, "Oh, I went to New York to CBGB's and saw a band play." And they were like, "What?" Like people just couldn't wrap their head around it. Or like, "Yeah, I played a show." Like, what do you mean you played a show? Like, where did everyone was just intrigued. Like, did you play? And it's like, "Oh, yeah, we played a Gangrene cover."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is. But that, I think that's the thing that also makes it special is I think Josh from Fucked Up said it when he was on the show that it's, this is the real red pill. Like the red pills that they peddle to you is that's bullshit. This was the real red pill because all of a sudden you didn't want to go to those fucking parties. You didn't care about getting invited. You didn't care who you sat and ate lunch with because none of that shit, all that shit's fucking fake and bullshit.
Yeah. It was like all of, you know, pretty much all of my friends went to other schools. And so it was like the weekends were my time of like this or like, you know, weeknights when there were shows. It was like, that was, and I knew it. I was just like, I know I had a good idea of who I was. And it's like, it's not this person, like these people, like I knew what direction I wanted to go in. And yeah, for better or for worse, still going.
We'd probably been all better off, you and me, if we had gotten into crypto.
Yeah, it's true. I know.
That would have been a way better investment than Rev Records on color vinyl.
I know. I'm just looking at my records right now. I got a hot tip. So we'll get in on the ground floor of the next one.
Oh yeah? All right. Let me know. Okay. If it's Ebullition singles from the 90s, I'm way ahead of you.
It's a new Ebullition coin. It's awesome. I'll send you the link.
I'm glad crypto crashed and burned before it got to the point that we had to worry about the Ebullition currency and
well, you know, there's always an upturn. There could be something else. So we'll see.
We could one day have Discord dollars in our crypto wallets.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it.
There's no way Hardcore Kids wouldn't buy a physical coin with a picture of Ian MacKay on one side and the sheep on the other.
Absolutely not. Oh, sick. See, there you go.
We should do this, actually. Now
did,
I'm thinking
we,
about it.
Did we just start a cryptocurrency?
Heads or tails. It's like a heads or tail coin. We're gonna make billions off this shit. We're going to be Ian MacKay rich by the time this is over.
God, I'm so excited. Has he been on the show before?
No, he'll never come on.
He doesn't want to do it.
I don't think so. I think he thinks I'm a little critical at times. I just love the impact that he had, and I love discussing it and breaking it down and stuff. But I went to the house one time, and my friend Chris O'Toole and I punished him for 5 hours in the house, just like, and it was awesome, and it was probably the greatest, greatest unrecorded punishment session I've ever had. But
now he's just like, "No, I'm good. I put in my time.
Yeah, like I don't know, for I shouldn't say he hasn't like formally said I'm not doing your show, but Discord was like, "You got to write him a letter." So I wrote this like heartfelty kind of letter, but there's left on red.
Like a physical
no,
letter?
No, an email. Maybe I'll next. That'll be my next step.
He only communicates through like analog communication.
I won't even open your fucking email, man. You gotta send me this shit. But it's interesting how like these people do become deified in a way,
yeah.
And that and it has very little relationship to the person. Ultimately, it's more just like us picking a particular age of this person's life and building that into some sort of god type figure for us. Like we when people worship Ian MacKaye as Harcourt, there's, you know, like you're saying with AN, like there's people that are like 7-inch only, background music only. I think with Ian MacKaye, it's the same way. There's some people that are like Fugazi era Ian and stuff. But as hardcore kids, we're worshiping a kid who's like 18 years old, 19 years old.
Yeah, and sorry, cat's falling on my keyboard.
I love the cameo. Oh, look at that.
Ralph. What's up, Ralph? Yeah.
Don't wreck it, Ralph. There he is.
Yeah.
It is weird how you do feel this connection to these people. And
yeah.
I guess on a mainstream popular level, that's definitely what it was happening with Frank too, but it happens in punk all the time. Like,
yeah, for sure.
Ian MacKaye, Kathleen Hanna, Wes, like there's just people that have been built into icons for people that they, you know, at the same time, you can't live up to someone's fucking icon. Like you're a human being. And so this person's always going to feel let down or have like a weird, unhealthy relationship to do this. And I'm saying this is someone with a weird, unhealthy relationship with Ian MacKaye.
Right. Okay. But I'm sure, I mean, do you get it as well as like a front man to, cause I feel like it happens a lot with front people where it's like, you're writing these lyrics and that's like the most it resonates with people because it's like, you know, it's not like no one comes up to me and like, oh, this guitar line changed my life. And it's like, it just doesn't happen. It's like, you know, words are this tangible
thing. I think anytime someone meets me, by the time they leave, I've just totally deflated their fandom. You know, like you gotta be Jandek. You gotta leave that mystery out there for people. But
yes.
You see me warts and all. Like
okay. So you just like deflate your own you're like, I'm gonna put a stop to this right now.
Yes.
Not hold me in any sort of, you will not raise me up.
No, I am my own legend killer.
That's my goal. I love it. Yes. Good. Like, that's your next band name, your epic metal band, legend killer.
There is though, like you do see that, like you're saying, like people coming up to, and it doesn't have to be a band that's blowing up and that's gone, you know, supernova in their popularity. Like you see it with Martin from Crudos and people like that expectation that he was going to give those speeches every single night.
Yeah.
He talked about when he was on the show. He's like, that was a lot of fucking pressure. And that was really fucking hard to have to go out there and try and say something impactful and profound every single night and get emotional and dig that shit up. And he's like, well, Limpress is a lot more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds exhausting. Like, and you know, I can only imagine.
Yeah, and there's not that. It's not like you get to go get on the private jet afterwards and just completely unplug. You want to sleep in some weird punk house basement or something. Yeah,
or driving into the overnight in a van with 7 other people,
or a murder motel where you're like, that's definitely blood. That's 100% blood.
I think something moved on my pillow. I'm not sure. I'll deal with the head lice tomorrow.
So A-Team and Suicide File overlap, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. There were some... we played... I did some double duty shows. And like one of... I want to say it was... I guess it was the last A-Team tour was... at the end of the last or one. No. So there was a Suicide File tour with AN, and then that ended in California, or Suicide File ended it in California. I went on to meet up with the A team in like Nashville, and then that like the AN tour, the A team played that show in Nashville, and then we went on into wherever, like up to Canada or somewhere.
It's interesting because like the Suicide File, it's definitely a very different sonic, but it feels like it's a very different fan base. Like there's crossover with the kids that like both bands, myself, but
yeah,
and lots of kids, but there was also like they were different sects within DIY hardcore.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Boston there was a lot of like there was still like a lot of, you know, every band would just sort of play together because that was just the scene, whether or not people would like it or not. But I feel like, you know, Suicide File and A-Team could play I feel like there was a mass art show that was like A-Team, Suicide File, and I don't know, maybe I'm getting, I don't know. But yeah, there were plenty of shows that were just like all of those bands would play together and there was no, people would get, everyone would get a good reaction. But yeah, I don't know if there was, I guess I don't really see it as that much different, but.
Yeah, like, and it's not that much different ultimately, but I think it's like an old school hardcore versus modern hardcore approach.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, both like informed from the same place, but like, yeah, I guess it was like Suicide File was sort of taking, like injecting something a little bit new into that old school hardcore realm.
Yeah, it's like that kind of like there's a almost I find, and I'm, you tell me if I'm completely talking my ass on this, but there's like a post Drive Like Jehu, post Helmet, post like a lot of these bands that once again are hardcore bands, punk bands, come out of punk and hardcore, but were doing something a little bit different and sort of this sort of like slightly different approach. Like, it's interesting looking back on it now and seeing, like you're saying, there's in the grand scheme of things, no difference between these two worlds, but there was,
yeah,
at the time it felt like a kind of a new sound emerging.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm thinking about like, I remember when the Suicide File demo came out and this was before I was in the band and it was like, oh, this is these guys trying to do like sort of that old, like old school LA punk vibe. Like old school Southern California vibe, that, you know, and then I guess with the LP, it sort of, it went a little bit more rock that direction. So yeah, it was, yeah, I guess I've never really thought about it.
Well, I think that's interesting that you, when you said that there too, because there's like, there is sort of that return to punk as opposed to like hardcore had become, this is hardcore and like it all mixes together, but like we're a fast hardcore band, we're informed by these hardcore bands, whereas in the more modern way you could bring tons of other influences in there and it wasn't considered like a sin.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was, and I think that's why that band sort of resonated with me when they came out, because it was like there was a little bit more melody and but still like hard and fast. So it was, yeah, it was good. It was definitely something different at the time.
How many times did you guys go to Europe?
Yeah, how many times did Suicide File? Only once. And this was like after we were, it was like a reunion thing that we did in 2006. Like we stopped being a band 2003. And then I think 2006, I can't remember. So basically, like, I was going to Europe playing bass for Panic. So Panic and Guns Up were doing a European tour one summer. And I had the bright idea of, like, oh, why doesn't, like, Suicide File tack on a reunion tour? Because, like, we had been asked about it over the years. So we ended up, like, booking this I was trying to extend my European summer vacation so tacked on a Suicide File tour at the end of it, Yeah, and it was like I think it was like another 2 weeks. But yeah, just the one, we just went the one time.
It's wild the impact that Suicide File has in terms of like there's just a lot of bands that I think are influenced by them. And once again, you guys were, on bigger hardcore labels, but it wasn't like you signed to, Victory or something like that, where there was that sort of like outreach where these records were everywhere. It was like a very organic kind of thing that spread.
Yeah, for sure. And it was like all done. It was done in like that very old school way where like, Indecision put out our record because Dave Mandel and Dave Weinberg were good friends. And it's like, oh yeah, it was all very organic. And I don't know if it was just because we were all sort of around for so long where it just like it reached out to all different branches of the scene. But yeah, it's still surprising like how it, like we played those Bane reunion shows over last summer, and it was some of the biggest, most insane shows that we've ever played. So it was, yeah, it's funny to still have it have any sort of impact, which, it's nice. I'll
And
take it.
Dave Mandel, UFC superstar photographer.
I know, it's crazy.
It's
Yeah, I
wild.
hadn't said, oh yeah, I mean he's crushing it. And we got to we did they did an Indecision 30-year fest over the summer, and Suicide File played that as well. And that was the first time I had seen Mandel in like probably over a decade. And like he's crushing it. He's just saw him do a backflip during Unbroken. That was great. Just,
That's awesome.
forever young.
I don't think I've seen him since 2001 when the Swarm Adamantium tour happened and I was
Sick.
their roadie.
Hell yeah.
The Swarm were very mean to me, but everyone in Adamantium was very nice, so I definitely
Oh yeah. Nicest Southern California guys.
not like those jerks from Worcester.
Yeah, Dave Mandel still looks exactly the same. Like it hasn't aged at all. So
Yeah,
yeah, if you see him again, you'll definitely recognize him.
well, it's funny. My friend was like, who's not into punk or hardcore, but it's a UFC guy. Was Do you know Dave Mandel? And I'm like, yeah. Well, and he's like, oh, check this out, and it's like all those photographs and stuff, which is, yeah, I don't know. It's awesome that you when years later you see people's names popping up in these different places, and you're like, oh yeah, we're all still weirdly connected by this cult we're a part of.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it all comes back. It was like, yeah, especially playing that fest, it was like seeing people that I hadn't seen since early 2000, like that Orange County scene where it was just, yeah, it was very, very fun reconnecting with people.
Yeah, like I have no interest in ever going to a high school reunion, but
No.
if like any of these bands reunite and I'm near it, those are the reunions I want to go to because that is
I mean,
my.
yeah, I mean, especially those Bane shows, that was like high school reunion for me. I was seeing so many people where I hadn't seen them in so long. And it was just like, spending a couple days in Boston back to back. And yeah, something I rarely do these days, but just, yeah, getting to see people that I hadn't seen, it was nice, to a certain extent. Sometimes you gotta hide yourself away, but yeah, pick and choose.
Yeah, you need that cloak of invisibility that they have in Lord of the Rings.
Yes, for sure.
To sneak in and out sometimes. Well, one person I'm never sneaking away from or hiding from is Joe Lifeline, Big
Oh
Joe.
yeah,
One of the
yes.
greatest people.
Yeah, sweetest individual, just always smiling, always having a good time. Yeah, I love Joe.
And like it's such a pure love of this thing too. Like he was a guy who never felt bogged down by, the little sect of this thing that he was a part of.
No,
He liked
yeah,
all
I'm
different types of bands.
yeah, I mean those it was like that early connection, like when we me and the other A-Team guys lived in a house together in Boston, Thrashford,
A legendary, infamous house.
legendary. But though, like those Chicago guys, like him and Mark Hurst, like they would come and stay with us. Just like, I don't even know. I guess it was like off of the Rev board or the Mullet board, or like, I don't even know where the connection came from. But like, they would just come and stay with us. Like, I just, it was such a normal thing where you just have someone that you're like loosely connected to. Like, yeah, just, come hang for the weekend. And like, we'd have a party and there would, there would be a show that those guys were coming to. And yeah, it's such a strange thing that doesn't happen anywhere else.
We invented
And
social media in punk. Like punk, like we didn't invent the internet, but like punk and hardcore was people that definitely invented, like going back to the letters and classified sections and MMRR and stuff. People like, but we were like, yeah, like early days of message boards. I had friends all over the place that I'd never met.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Gibby from The Trouble and Panic doing Makeout Club, like that was a big thing, even though it was like I was never on it. I wasn't in the Makeout Club scene, but friends I know that it was like definitely a connector where you just find people to hang out with just because you were loosely associated with this one little scene.
Yeah, it was definitely like I was never on it. I don't photograph well. But it felt like it was somewhere where people were meeting people. It was certainly a dating app in some ways. Like
For sure.
when Panic came to Toronto on that, I think it was the first, yeah, it was the first 7-inch. Gibby and Damien went and stayed with someone they knew from Makeout Club, and the other guy stayed at our house. And it felt like a very, at the time, it was like, what the hell is this thing? Obviously, it's just an extension of message board culture. But now, looking at the world we live in, it was like, oh my God, we were doing that first.
Yeah, on the ground floor for sure.
Yeah. And the idea of having friends all over the place and the only thing that connects you is shared interests is just not a normal human thing.
No, not at all.
But we did
Like,
it.
yeah, for sure. It's not like that sort of water cooler office talk where, talking about what your kids did this weekend or what, talking about TV shows that you saw last week. Like it's something that I think it's a more tangible, resonating thing where, I feel it's a deeper connection that you have to these random people all over the world, which, I'm very appreciative of it.
Yeah, because we chose these friends. They weren't forced on us by where we were making our living.
Well, some were forced on
Some
us.
would
That's
definitely be right. That's that invisibility cloak coming back into
exactly.
play for us to get away from.
But yeah, I mean the fact that, as I'm sure, as I'm sure you do too, it's like you have some of the same friends that you in high school or earlier, where it's like you still see these people all the time and you have these very strong bonds. And yeah, and it doesn't exist in a lot of places like outside of that this music scene, which, because you kind of like, not to say that you like went to battle together, but it's like you had all of these collective experiences and lots of memories, so it's a strong, very strong bond.
It's also weird how there's like an international language where if you say certain artists, certain labels, certain magazines, it immediately evokes the same picture for everybody. Like you say Gigi Allen, everyone immediately knows who's part of this thing, who you're talking about, or when you talk about Ian MacKaye, there's an image that's kind of like different for people, but it's certainly somewhat universal in how it's kind of taken up, and it's. And that's something that happened almost completely organically. It's not in a book or anything.
No. Yeah. Sorry.
No, I
You're
love the cameos.
you're just you're making me lose track. Come on.
I was just saying how it's like it's a shared cultural experience and language and things that we kind of happens completely organically.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and it goes back to like I was thinking the other day about how, I mean, it gets a little diluted now, but like how you would just see people dressed a certain way. Like if you saw someone with a flight jacket with some pins on it, like it's like, oh, this is a person that I probably have some shared interests with.
Yeah.
And that would just be like that. That's like how you would make friends. Like, oh, you would see someone, like I said, when I met Danny Bignuts from the Goonies, like he had a Bane shirt on or something. So it's like, oh, I'm going to go talk to this kid. Like, I don't know who he is, but you know, we're going to obviously be able to have some sort of conversation and find some common ground. I mean, I don't know. It's funny, 'cause I feel like with a younger generation now that it's like, now that like that sort of like skinhead culture has become like a fashion statement, it like now I see kids with like, or people with flight jackets on and like kind of dress vaguely skinhead, but wouldn't necessarily know who like the partisans are, you know?
I feel like,
so it's like, so now I don't know. It's like, and like, even, and also like that sort of like punk look, like sometimes it could just be not connected to any sort of music. It's purely fashion, but it makes it that much more special for like the people that I do think you need to, I love like reading about like people gatekeeping. It's like, yeah, you gotta do it to a certain extent. You got like welcome in new people that want to learn, but you got to kind of protect it from the people that are just culture vultures.
It also feels like music doesn't have the same sort of cultural identity attached to it now that it did in the era where you had to pay for it. You had to like search it out in a different, and that's not to say that people aren't punks now and people aren't hardcore kids.
Oh no.
But you,
yeah, did... I'm
go on. Sorry.
No, you.
But at the same time, there's this sort of drive to, or there's not that drive to kind of identify yourself by dressing a certain way, which means you listen to a certain type of music, which means, because you don't have to make those kind of choices in the same way anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's good and bad to, like, I love that there is this sort of new era of like punk and hardcore where like everything is kind of acceptable. Like nothing's off the table. Like hearing people do like shit with like 90s like drum and bass break beats and yeah. Like I love stuff like that. It's like that's just being creative and that's like getting weird, and or like any sort of melody and like a little poppier side to things. Like if it's done well and done from a place where it, you know, an honest place, like it, you know, any, I love that nothing's off the table. Like I always was attracted to those sort of bands that like just kind of did the weird, like one of my favorite bands from Massachusetts of like that late 90s scene was Get High. Mm-hmm. And like they were just, you know, they would play these bigger shows but like never really got their due because they were just doing this sort of like little post-punk, little, you know, but then early 80s hardcore, like this like mishmash of, and I just always liked those weirder bands. And I think now it's like that's kind of become the norm to like throw in these little twists and turns that, and I'm here for it for sure. But like it has to be coming from a place of you know, legitimacy and honesty.
You brought up Get High there. I think Dive's another band that is,
oh, not, God, yeah,
do not appreciate it outside of that area.
Well, that was just, you know, it was, and Dive was a band like the tail end of like right when I was sort of getting into, I never got to see them. But yeah, they were just like this mythological, like, oh yeah, this local band, them and Hatchet Face was like, oh, that's like, and like Fit for Abuse, it was like that had all sort of just ended. And yeah, it was like I remember the first time getting my hands on like someone made me a copy of the Dive record, and I was just like, holy shit, I can't believe I missed this band by like months. Yeah, but also it was just a time where like people weren't, it wasn't like a, if you were in a local band, it wasn't like touring. Like they weren't, I think they might have played New York a couple times or maybe gone down to New Jersey, but like, you know, they weren't touring. They were just like playing these local shows. So yeah, never really got outside of Massachusetts, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it's also with Get High and Dive and Sam Black Church and a lot of these bands, it's like a unique approach to this thing that's not in line with like the mosh metal stuff or the power violence stuff or like all these other kind of 90s very defined little movements that were happening in hardcore. Like in Boston, there's like a weirder edge to everything in throughout the 80s and 90s.
It's like that little, you know, towny Massachusetts weirdo, like very suburban. Cause like even bands from Boston, most of the people aren't from Boston. Like there's a handful of people that I can think of where it's like, oh, you're Bostonians and you're involved in punk and hardcore. Like everyone I know that was like in the Boston scene usually moved there at a certain point, and myself included. But it's like, that sort of, I don't know. It's like this weird suburban boredom. I always think of like Adam and Steve from Caven and like those guys. They always talk about like this suburban towny metalhead. Like that's, you know, that's just what we were, and then we like slowly got into all this other stuff but it all informed like what it became. But it's like I honestly think it's like comes mostly out of being bored in the suburbs and, you know, just finding friends that you can play music with. And like, you're just going to throw in any sort of weird jokes and whatever keeps you entertained, and it could ultimately become something that's influential to other people in a strange way.
Well, and it's also interesting because in the mid 80s and into the 90s and throughout the 90s, there's like it's not like it's not relevant, but it's not necessarily connected to the hardcore scene. But then by the late 90s with Converge, Dropkick Murphys, like the Cave-In, and certainly like, you know, the In My Eyes and that whole kind of world too, it was like the zeitgeist of hardcore by the late 90s.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, and it's strange that like all of those bands that you just listed, that they're even connected, like, because if it's someone that would, you know, that knows the Dropkick Murphys now, like the fact that they have this like very straight line connection to like Converge, and it's just, you know, but all of those things were just together in one spot, just because it was like that. It was a smaller scene and everyone would play together. And like, I'm trying, like, there's always a flyer of this place, St. John's Gym in Clinton, which is just outside of Worcester. And there was like, I remember going to this show where it was like Neurosis, Today Is the Day, Converge. Like, it was just like, which, you know, those bands would just be all like festival headliners now, but yeah. That was just like, they, you know, not that they're that different. They are all pretty similar, but like that shit just like happened normally, where it was just like, yeah, well, because this is a place to play, we'll have whatever. Like, it would be like, you know, Piebald playing with Converge and bands, or like Six Going on Seven playing with Overcast, and all these like there would be like bands that were very different, but all informed from like the same place. But there was like a common bond that would tie everything together. I think that was just me rambling, but.
Well, no, you're right. Cause it makes sense in Boston that all these bands would play together, but like anywhere else, it would be like, no, these are completely different scenes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, looking, you know, like I said, like looking back, if someone didn't know what was going on at the time, be like, why are these bands playing together? Like, what? It doesn't make any sense. But at the time, it you wouldn't even bat an eye. It would just kind of be like, yeah, this is just a show. Like, I guess it's like, I mean, everything was sort of like, oh yeah, I'm going to a show, not necessarily a straight hardcore show. There would be like some emo bands and some indie rock or like weird electronic stuff. And yeah, it was a little bit of everything, which was great.
Well, even as like a fan buying the records, like I'm like, okay, Big Wheel, Recreation. They put out like 10 Yard Fight and the Fast Break Split. Like, this is a hardcore yeah. label. And then buying some of the stuff and being like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, what was it? They came from Massachusetts comp where it was like all of the Big Wheel stuff, where it was like, you know, Cast Iron Hike doing a G.G. Allin cover. And then it was like Six Going on Seven. And what else was on? I mean, yeah, I think Bane.
Get High, I think, is on it, right?
Get High was on there, yeah. I mean, yeah, that was a weird label where it was fully like a local scene, like Rama just put it like, oh yeah, I like your band, I'm going to put out your record. And it's cool. Like it, yeah, it, all, a lot, most of those bands, if not just the people in the band, went on to do a lot of bigger stuff. And that was a big one, getting that comp where it's like, oh, it's all different. This is a little bit of everything. Like, it's so cool what our scene is.
It was funny. I was in LA a couple years ago hanging with my friend Abdullah, and we're like smoking weed at this building called, like, it's like a weed marketing building. And we're smoking a blunt in an office, and I'm talking to the guy that runs the company, and he's like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I was singing in a band. He's like, oh, I used to run a punk label back in the day. I'm like, what label? He's like, Big Wheel.
Oh no.
I'm like, your label's fucking crazy. That's the weirdest label.
You just ran into Ramamayo just randomly.
Weed brings us all together. All the ex straight edge kids find themselves smoking blunts together at some point.
Okay. All right.
I don't know if he was straight edge ever, but he definitely isn't.
I don't
anymore.
Think so. No. I'm pretty sure him and Dickie Cummings were not the straight edge guys.
Well, I definitely have now joined them. We found unity together.
Love it. Yeah. Like you said, brings us all together.
I guess we've talked for a long time. And Jim, anytime you want to come back on this show, you're more than welcome. I'd love
to. Yeah. There's so much we haven't covered, you know?
No. But before you go, we got to cover one more thing.
Let's do it.
How did you meet Simon Doom?
Oh, yeah. That's easy. We met at Guitar Camp in Boston. So we were both going to this Berklee summer program, and it was, you know, like I said before about like seeing someone that I think he had like a Nausea shirt on and was like carrying around a little mini CD boombox. And I was like, oh yeah, this is like a kid that I want to talk to. And I think I had like a camo Locust shirt on. Like, I think I was just wearing that all summer. And yeah, we both sort of like, you know, picked each other out in the crowd. And yeah, we ended up like hanging for that whole summer just because we were like the two like punk hardcore kids going to that program, because it was so filled with like, you know, shredder dorks and, you know, actual serious musicians, and we were just sort of the goofy punk kids. But yeah, it was, you know, hung out for a whole summer and then got disconnected because there was no social media, and then reconnected like 15 years later in Brooklyn randomly at a bar. And yeah, rest is history.
Did you know right away that it was him? Did you guys immediately make that connection?
So we were at, I think it was like an after, sort of an after party for like some mutual friends show. And I was talking to someone, I guess I had my back to him, and like someone had said my name, and then I just heard like Jim Carroll, and I turned around and I was like, Simon? And it was like immediately like, holy shit, I haven't seen you in so long. And like big hug, and we sort of like just reconnected and like, you know, went over whatever we had been you know, missing for the last 15 years. And at the time, so that was when I was doing Pure Love, and a few months later when Pure Love played that show in Brooklyn, Simon played bass for us.
Oh, I had no idea.
So that was like a random thing. And then a few months after that is when Simon Doom, he started Simon Doom, and we were playing together. So, and then from there, Spiral Heads, and so it's just been a musical love affair this whole time.
Well, this has been fun the whole time, buddy, because you got a lot of different places you pop up throughout this culture and make cool records every time. So thanks for coming
Yeah,
on,
thank
man.
you. Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Jim will be back for a part two at some point in the near future. So check out Till I'm Dead, and that is that. Check out the Hope Conspiracy record too. That's fantastic that they put out last year as well. Check out all the things Jim does. Dig into the Jim's back catalog. Check out all these fantastic bands and go on a journey. Speaking of going on a journey, we're gonna be going on a journey probably tomorrow when I put out this next episode, because tomorrow on the show from the band Pitbull, the legendary Mikey Pitbull will be on the show. And this is a good one. If you're not familiar with Pitbull, they are a foundational kind of Detroit capital H hardcore band, not from that Negative Approach era, but like the sound that I think many of us today associate with Detroit. That to me starts really with Pitbull. And oh boy, this is a good one. But you'll hear that probably tomorrow, because it's all in lead up to the screening of Dope Hookers and Pavement, the Detroit hardcore documentary happening here in Toronto. You probably heard an ad for it at the top of the show, but it's going to be going down this Sunday, if you're listening to this thing when it comes out, at the great Innistown Hall. I love going to see movies there. A lot of good memories of seeing different things there over the years. And so come on out. But before that, check out this episode with Mikey Pitbull. You will not be disappointed. All right. That is it for today's show. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different races. Because we're not talking about different nationalities, different sexualities, different identities. Because we're not talking about politics here. This is just basic human rights stuff. Ceasefires are just basic human rights stuff. So if there's organizations that are doing and affecting positive change in this world, get involved. You donate your time, donate your money. Because I'm sure they could use that if you have money to spare and you'll feel better. Not that you're doing it for yourself, but it's like a good side effect. Speaking of doing things, get out there, start a band, start a fanzine, start a record label, start a podcast. Just make your own culture. Punk gets better when you contribute to it. And it's designed for you to contribute to it. That's what it's all here for. Put on a show. Open a show space. Now we're getting a little bit grandiose. To bring it back to reality, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And I've seen miracles happen because people have signed those cards. So you can affect positive change. You're dead, so you really won't be able to reap those benefits. But not that you're doing it because you want to reap the benefits. That's the wrong reason to do it. But you'll be doing something great. That's some good things to kind of go to your death knowing. Ah, fuck. Gave someone else a new lease on life, hopefully. All this heavy shit, try meditating. It really does help you process this stuff. And I'm definitely not the first person to say that meditation works. But I can tell you that I might be the least likely to have said that. No, probably not. But anyway, try meditating. All right, that's it for me. Thank you for listening. See you on the next episode.